एक मिनट रुक जाओ, रेडी होने दो। चलो ये कर लेते हैं, दिस कुड बी अ ग्रेट इंट्रो।
हाय, आई एम अक्षय।
हाय, दिस इज सौरभ एंड यू आर लिसनिंग टू द फाउंडर थीसिस पॉडकास्ट। वी मीट सम ऑफ द मोस्ट सेलिब्रेटेड स्टार्टअप फाउंडर्स इन द कंट्री
एंड वी वांट टू लर्न हाउ टू बिल्ड अ यूनिकॉर्न।
सो माय नेम इज शांतनु देशपांडे एंड आई एम द फाउंडर एंड सीईओ ऑफ बॉम्बे शेविंग कंपनी।
D2C is the flavor of the season in India, but the opportunity for creating generational brands is very real, and today's D2C brands will become FMCG giants of tomorrow. Leading the pack in the men's grooming market is Bombay Shaving Company, which counts FMCG giants like Reckitt Benckiser and Colgate Palmolive as its strategic investors. And its founder, Shantanu Deshpande, is truly a gifted strategist who left a well-paying consulting job to create an FMCG brand that is today worth 100 crores. Listen to Shantanu decode the growth hacks and the mental models that helped him scale up so fast and become the leader of the pack in his space.
So I was born in Dallas, and my father was in TCS for a really long time. So from 78 to 93, 94, he was in TCS, and for 3-4 years in another company. So he was a part of a small team that set up a lot of the TCS offices in the 80s in the US. So I was born in Dallas, and he was part of the Dallas office, and we were in Boston for a few years, we were in New York for a couple of years. We were then in Florida for 3-4 years. So around, we stayed around the place. And then in 97, he was offered a job in Pune to be CEO at Tech Mahindra, which at that time was a very small Mahindra Group IT company. This is around the time when IT was slowly starting to pick up. And Mahindra had British Telecom as a, you know, sole client. And he was asked to come in and lead that business. So 97 to 2004, he was there. But it was a good job. My grandmoms were getting older and my parents were like, okay, fine, kids are getting older, so let's go back. It was a decision my brother and I were absolutely against, because for me, India was all about summer vacation, just coming back during the summer vacation and so on. And I, if you have cousins or someone who comes from US every other year, they dress differently, they talk differently, they're always the weird, unique types. And I never felt at home in India, even though this is family. But my brother and I were very unhappy about the move back. But I think after a year or so, we were fairly comfortable with it.
Okay. And so, like, what had you thought, during your teen years, that you will go back to the US and study, or you were like pretty much settled into India?
No, so my brother and I joined a very, very traditional school in Pune. Called Vikhe Patil, and we were young, right? So we Indianized fairly quickly. US became a distant memory. So, then after that, we acclimatized to India very well. I continue to hold a US passport, but going back to the US has never been an option. My brother, on the other hand, for education, he was at IIT Bombay, then he did his PhD from Stanford. And kind of has been an academic and now working at a hedge fund in the US. So his interest did not allow for a professional pursuit in India. But for me, India always is option number one. And I, other than maybe a couple of years in the US, I don't think I will ever think about staying there. India is a very exciting place now.
True. So did you also pursue the path of engineering like your brother and your dad?
Absolutely. So I was between my brother and I, he was a lot more academically smart than I was. I did try for IIT, didn't make it, went to NIT Nagpur, did my computer science. I was a fairly sharp kid in the sense I knew how to clear my exams and do well, but was never an engineering enthusiast. It was just something that kids who were good at mathematics and science would do. So that's why I did it. But beyond that, I knew that I wanted to do something more. So when final year came, I was like, okay, fine, I want to start thinking about management as a postgraduate option. So CAT became a really, CAT, GMAT, stuff like that was what my final year in engineering was all about.
Okay. How were you in the engineering years? Were you focused on studies, or were you outgoing extrovert types, or?
Yeah, I was an outgoing. I was very outgoing, very extrovert. I was. I lived in a hostel, so I had a lot of friends. I'm the kind of person, Akshay, who kind of identifies and associates with my community / my institution very quickly from an identity standpoint. So for the 4 years I was at NIT Nagpur, I was a proud NIT Nagpur alumnus. You know, I was a proud student. I was a member of the college football team, so it became a very big passion for me. I was the sports secretary of the college, so building a sports infrastructure became very important to me. And when I went to IIM Lucknow, for example, IIM Lucknow is not at the same level of Ahmedabad, Bangalore, Calcutta, right? I mean, it's a newer institute and so on. So, but I always felt that, so I got involved with the fest at IIM Lucknow, and I felt our fest should be bigger in sponsorship and size than all the others. And then when I joined McKinsey, which was like a big deal for me because McKinsey doesn't recruit so many people from L as they do from the others. I felt that Lucknow should do well in McKinsey. And then, now I'm a proud McKinsey alumnus, and I feel that McKinsey is, so I'm the kind of person who kind of really associates with the institution that I'm a part of. I was a footballer. I was a fairly extroverted kid. I had a motorcycle. So, naturally just moving around the city was a lot more fun. I was a very, 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 very happy 4 years ahead. I made my best friends there.
And straight after NIT, you got into IML.
Yes, I gave my cat in my final year first shot. It was 6 years of hostel life back to back. So good fun.
Okay. So, you wanted to get into consulting, you're now in the FMCG space, and a lot of people during B school have, the most popular are banking, FMCG, consulting. So what was it that you wanted to do?
So, yeah, that's a good question. I did not want to do, I did not even know what consulting was when I went to B school. It's insane how little I knew about the management world when I entered IIM Lucknow. Okay. And I was one of only 7 freshers on a batch of 350. So other people, they were like, our average experience of 3 or 4 years. So people around me kind of worked, they figured out what they wanted to do, and so on. Two things happened, right? I think one is I got a job. My internship was at Nokia during my Lucknow summers, right? I had Nokia at that time, was 2010. So Nokia was run like an FMCG company. It was 17,000-18,000 crores of top line, and just phones would like kind of fly. So the top management, Shiv Kumar, Vineet Taneja, all of these are ex-Levers guys. So top management was all ex-Levers, Cadbury. Nokia, while it was a phone company, was run like FMCG.
Yeah, and it was ubiquitous. I mean, the only phone banner and logo you'll see all around the country was probably Nokia at that time.
100%. Everyone had Nokia. It was 100% market share business. And I remember April, I had 7th, my internship started. And my first week there was the 31st March is financial year closing, right? So there was the party for the sales team, which I was a part of. So all the top sales managers would achieve their target. The top guy was given a Honda City. So it was a big deal, right? And the guy on the top, I think was Vijayawada or one of these places, had achieved like 700% of his target. And I caught up with him over a drink, and he was like, it's not like I did something 7x more. It's just that our phone sells so much. But this is the peak, right? Because after that, within 2 years, Nokia had started falling significantly compared to Samsung and some of the other brands.
Yeah, yeah. I think around that time, the sale had happened, like 13, 14 only, I guess, the sale to Microsoft happened.
Correct. So by the way, I got an offer from Nokia to join full-time. I was fully convinced that I want to join Nokia as a sales manager. And I love the place and so on. When final month arrived, I was allowed to apply for companies that come before Nokia to the campus. Or maybe one or two. I had an option to apply to 2 companies that come before Nokia to campus. If I get those two, through those two, that's good. Otherwise, I have to take the Nokia offer. So I, obviously, consulting comes first. So McKinsey, Boston Consulting Group, Deutsche, Goldman, all of these companies. I chose McKinsey and Boston Consulting Group because those are the... I felt I was a better consultant than I would be a banker and so on. But I was still not very keen to like prepare for it, or I was not even sure I was going to get shortlisted. I had gotten shortlisted by BCG in the summers, and I had a horrible interview problem. I had one interview and I did not, like, it happened in the afternoon and I did not get, you know, get the offer, and it was very, very painful. I always felt that consulting is way outside my league. Like, I'm not fit for it, you know. But at that time, I had really started liking this girl in my batch. And, you know, I had like a big crush on her, and she was, you know, kind of very supportive. And she said, hey, you know, you should, why don't you have two options? Why don't you apply? She also had a PPO from a bank, but she wanted to get into consulting. And she said, she should apply. And I was like, I will, but I don't think anything's going to really happen out of it. And she's like, no, you apply, you'll be really good. You're good with words. You're a sharp problem solver. Why? I mean, my grades are not good enough. And, you know, I had a bad BCG experience. And she's like, no, do it. So I'm going to do it and I'm going to prepare. So, you know, let's prepare together. And I was like, okay, that's a good enough. Do it, right? So I applied and I got the shortlist. I didn't get one from BCG, but I got one from McKinsey. And I was one of those guys who on my CV did not even put my academic grade, it was not great. So the shortlist itself was a surprise. But I'm like, cool, now that I'm shortlisted, might as well prepare. She got all the shortlists, right? She was academically much, much better than I was. And I used the month to like really work hard on my case preparation and interview prep. And it's a fairly intense process. And as the preparation happened, actually, I realized I'm really good. I was really good at it, like surprisingly good at it. Like, towards the end, right, I still remember, distinctly remember that the date of 28th of Feb 2011 was my process. 21st, 22nd of Feb was when McKinsey came to campus for an event. And they do like this for the whole month before the process. They come to campus, they do workshops, all of that stuff, right? So they came and I remember one of the guys there who was ex-IIM Lucknow and said that, you know, hearing a lot of good things about you and we might put you in the interview list. We might bring you first in front of the partners and so on. And I was like, cool, my reputation has kind of gone. And like, even like toppers from the shortlist were like calling me up and saying, hey, Shantanu, can we get an hour of prep time with you? Which is like never happened for the 2 years there, right? So I was fairly confident going into the party. But yeah, so she got into BCG on that day. And I got into McKinsey, and we are happily married today. So, you know, all's well.
Oh, that's quite a love story. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, we started dating around during that week, because I think the prep time, and there's so many distractions. She'd gone for student exchange, so she was not in India for a while, and then she came back, and then we prepped. And then I think once the placements happened, and then we had like a few months before we joined, that's when we had like some breathing time, and you know, before we left campus, we kind of formalized that, you know, we were like, okay, fine, are we like dating or are we not? You know, what do we tell our friends? You know, and it was good because consulting was great because you fly in on Monday and you fly out on Thursday or Friday, and she had the same gig. So Thursday, Friday, we would kind of fly to, we tried to fly to similar locations and kind of, you know, the firm sponsored our initial courtship. It was great.
Wow. Okay. So, what was the base location at McKinsey for you?
Bombay. I'm from Pune, right? So my parents are in Pune, so I took Bombay. But I never did a Bombay project. I always did stuff outside Bombay. My first year was in, you know, Udaipur. My second year was in Orissa. I did a lot of work in Delhi. Sakshi is located in Delhi. So my 2014 is when we got married. So 2013 and 14. I took a lot of Delhi-based projects. I did insurance, cement. I did a couple of projects in Bangalore. I did a couple of projects outside India. I did one project in Mumbai.
What was the typical mandate that you would get? Like, improve our profitability? Or like, what was it like?
Yeah, so McKinsey is a very, like, McKinsey as a firm attaches a team of 4 to 5 people at the very top of the organization, right? And so I served, like, my first job was to increase zinc production in a company. My second job was to reduce the cost of procurement for coal for a power plant. My third mandate was to create strategic plans for 5 years for a heavy engineering business of around 18,000-19,000 crore top line. Then I had to do learning and development for insurance agents for a life insurance company. Like, how do you train agents, right? Like, 13,000 agents, how do you train them? So what's the, so it's very diverse. I then did a cement sales transformation. There's a company in India selling cement How do you increase the output by 20% in terms of volume? How do you use price levers, branding levers? This is really interesting problems across the board. My last project was agriculture. Pesticides, insecticides, weedicides. How do you brand them? What kind of molecules do you use for the Indian farmer? So it was really interesting. Like I had a blast. I always felt like I was the dumbest person in a McKinsey room. Very smart people, very sharp. You know, I think that job was tailor-made for someone like me, right? 4 to 5 months in a project, you know, rigorous problem solving, very analytical. And then your bosses keep changing. So you keep like learning from new people, new clients, new environments and so on. Oh, brilliant place too. I think 5 years at McKinsey would be like 15 years at any other place from an intrinsic building standpoint. I kind of look at my 5 years and think about a lot. I don't know whether it's a good thing or not, but a lot of the way I think, the way I plan, the way I do things professionally is guided by the way I learned to do things at McKinsey. So
basically you learn to think big right from day one as an entrepreneur if you are coming out of a consulting company, I guess.
I think so. So there are 2-3 kinds of people at McKinsey. I don't think consulting is great for entrepreneurship, to be very honest. Right? I think from an intrinsic standpoint, it is good because it creates amazing networks for you. It teaches you how to talk to like board management, shareholder management, you know, and financial analysis, etc. It does very well for you. And problem solving, it really teaches you. How do you structure a problem? How do you break it down, etc. I think the issue with consulting, where consulting and entrepreneurship kind of conflict from a requirement standpoint, is I think the consulting world teaches you to analyze a little more than needed and kills what I think is maybe risk-taking / judgment-driven decisions. You know, sometimes feel aati hai, sometimes you feel that this is the right thing to do. Sometimes things don't make sense, but in your mind they do, right? Entrepreneurs need to follow instinct a lot on a lot of things. You can't keep waiting for the perfect
data to.
You need to take calls. Consulting doesn't give you the comfort naturally to do that. Consultants are fairly conservative people that way.
But a lot of founders who scale fast, I have seen, have a consulting background.
Yeah. So yeah, they do. I think it is more to do with overlap of excellence pool than it is to do with the fact that because they are consultants. I just feel like really good people from India end up going to IITs or IIMs or, you know, SRCC or whatever. And then really good people of those really good people get selected into McKinsey or BCG or whatever, right? So now you suddenly have the cream there. Now you get the cream to go and do something, whatever it is, whether it's being an entrepreneur or whatever, the chances of them doing it well will be much higher than the chances of an average person doing it who's not from a pool of excellence.
Plus the investor's willingness to back is also much higher.
Yeah. You take the 100 people who are selected for the IAS for India this year, and you tell those 100 people ki agle 5 saal ab IAS mat karo, ab entrepreneur ban jao. The chances of them doing well is very high, because anyways those are it's a very high pool of excellence, right? So I think it's more that than consulting. But yeah, I think consulting also gives you like access to promoters. A lot of consultants, like especially partners, are very close to like senior founders of large multi-billion dollar businesses. They're very close, they're advisors to them. So they firsthand see how they think, how they decide, how they build leadership teams. A lot of those things come in very handy.
So how did you end up leaving consulting for an entrepreneurial venture?
So two, three triggers, right? I think 2004, my dad was 50 years old, 49 years old. To be very honest, I lived a very luxurious and privileged and rich. So I had a childhood which was very well endowed. But my dad sat us down in 2004 and said, hey guys, look, Shantanu, you're now going to Nagpur. And Yash is now, he's finishing his 10th and is fairly, you know, is fairly independent and will do well in life. So I am not going to put aside any money for your education. Do you guys want to go to the US? And we both said no. said, okay, I don't need to put any money for the education. We have bought a house. Your mom and I don't need a lot. I'm now going to become an entrepreneur. So I did not understand what that meant. So I said, what does that mean? He's like, look, I mean, you won't believe. He actually told us how much he made at Tech Mahindra as CEO. Like, these are my stock options. This is how much I made. This is what. And he comes from like sheer poverty. Akshay, my dad, like, my dad and his three siblings and the mom, like my grandfather passed away when my dad was 7, and my dad was the oldest of the 4 siblings. The others were even smaller. And my grandmom was on a government teacher salary. So that's how they lived their life. Then he went to BITS Pilani, then IIT, and then joined TCS. And then when he went to the US, and then he started seeing the world. He comes from nothing. And he sat us down and he showed us his salary and how much we have saved. What are the ratchet days, so all of that. So now he said, I'm putting in this much, 20% of my savings into a company and I'm starting up on that. And I'll introduce you. His co-founder was a professor of computer science at IIT Kanpur. He said, I'll introduce you to Praveen. But now we will not be able to go on international vacations. We'll have to cut down on some of our spending, etc. So are you guys okay with that? And my mom was very comfortable. Like, my mom is one of those Sadhu Sant type people. Like, you put her in a one room kitchen with like 4,000 rupees a month, she will manage in that also. She's very happy. So she said, sure, so this is exciting. And my brother and I were so excited by this whole thing, because that meant that dad would be home a lot more. It just meant that I did not realize, but for us, his job as CEO was very demanding. So he would like be out of Pune half the time, come home late in the night. We missed our dad. So we were like, great. So he set up an office inside the house. We had like a big whiteboard and everything. And until there were like 5, 6, 7 people, they used to work out of our home, which is amazing.
And this was like a software company that he set up.
So he set up this company called Mojo Networks, which at that time was called Airtight Networks. Airtight was a Wi-Fi security device business. Basically, they would put devices to secure any Wi-Fi network which had sensitive information on it. So think about any defense building or any bank which has sensitive information, they will put the device. The Pentagon in the US, for example, has airtight devices in it. So they basically build Wi-Fi security. So they sold their business in 2019 to Arista Networks. My dad doesn't want my brother and me to get complacent about life. So he's very, very particular. He said we have a family lawyer for many years. My dad, obviously, because he would travel a lot, he had made a will. Every year he would make my brother and me read his will. But last 2 years he has not. So I'm assuming that he told the lawyer that the will is there, and when the time is right, you please let Shantanu and Yash know what needs to be done. That's pretty much where it is. But I think their lifestyle has not changed. And my sense is it's a significant amount of, but I think for someone who built a business of 15 years, he was CEO of Tech Mahindra, right? And he started a company at 50. 50 to 60 is when CEOs maximize their financial gains. He was going to be made CEO, and he could have been a CEO of another company. He built Tech Mahindra from a 40 crore business to like an 800 crore top line business, and almost taken them public and then so on. Right. So I think he was fairly ambitious and risk-taking that. But for me, that was one, like, my dad's journey and seeing it so close from a young age was a big driver for me to do this. The second thing, I think McKinsey pilot is amazing for the first 4-5 years. It starts becoming a little bit about partnership. How do you make partners? Who are your clients? Stuff that is not fundamentally about client service. And that became a little boring for me. Which partner are you associating with, or what's your practice and stuff like that. So, and the third thing was that I met two people who are really respected at McKinsey left for like startup jobs, right? So one guy went on to become the CEO of Flipkart. One guy went on to become CEO at Mintra, Anand and Zaiki. And I was like, these guys made senior partner last year and now have now left. What's the point? Like, it's not 15 saal you work hard and you become senior partner with amazing salary and respect and all. And then you leave for startups, and what's the point, right? So that was the third trigger. But I think the fourth trigger was a friend of mine in the US had interned at Harry's, which at that time was an amazing men's grooming brand, today, like good men's grooming brand out of the US. And he told me that, you know, look at this Dollar Shave Club video, and, you know, they're taking on Gillette and this and that. I'm like, that's so cool. And I started thinking about this. Also, a very good friend of mine in Bombay at the time was a brand manager at Axe. So he and I would talk about men's grooming and how Axe is getting killed by fog. So a lot of things started happening in 2014, 2015, which kind of, you know, told me that I want to build an FMCG brand of mine. Plus, FMCG was always a love. Like, it was something I always felt that HUL, Nokia, Procter, Colgate, Reckitt would be where I would build my career until McKinsey happened, right? So I felt that I had the chops, the intrinsics, the interest, the passion to build something. And I felt building a brand for men made sense because there weren't many around. You know, beauty was something that was far more indexed in women than it was in men. But over the last 20 years, we know that men have started wanting to look good a lot, especially after social media, life casting. You want to get right swiped on Tinder, you know, your profile picture, you want good stuff on Instagram. See, but you don't, like, two guys never talk about grooming. It's just socially unacceptable. But three girlfriends are very comfortable talking about lip color or hair, shampoo, or, hey, I love your cheeks. What moisturizer do you use? You'll never hear a guy tell his friend, even if they're very close friends, you know, dude, till daddy was a year. So you need a brand there to tell men because it has started becoming important for them, but like society is not a place to get answers. So all that put together, I felt that good time to start Bombay Shaving Company.
Was there a certain amount of naive optimism? Let's start an FMCG company. I mean, it just sounds naively optimistic.
Yeah, so I was on naive optimism. I felt that, again, like a consultant, I kind of figured out, is the market large? Yes. Are the margins good? Yes. Is the internet a place where you can start creating brand stories? Yes.
How many months did you spend researching this thesis before you took the plunge?
Probably it was researching, but it was ruminating in my head for a year and a half or so at least. I felt there's a good way to build a men's grooming brand in India, and here's the way to do it. There are multiple approaches, right? So Fog approach was take a category like deodorant, which is very cluttered, and totally create a differentiation through the proposition, which is, you know, Artso spray, no gas, right? And just build an offline brand, which is a brilliant, and marketed on television. That was brilliant. You need a lot of money for it. You're not able to raise that kind of money upfront because no one will pay. I had no credentials as an FMCG operator. So the other approach was enter a subcategory where you can build a certain amount of premium brand equity and then use that equity to then launch in other subcategories. So then we said, okay, that's the way we want to do it. And take on the biggest subcategory, which is shaving. And then take on Gillette and razors and blades. And then once you build an equity there, okay, you're a great guy, great design, very premium products, great experiences, then you have the license to play in multiple other categories. So that's, we kind of did it in a different way.
And you decided from day one to be like a D2C online brand, or you wanted to have offline also?
I'm a believer that Indian retail is built offline. Sustainably, right? Sure, you can get initial traction, first 5 crores a month, 3 crores a month, 2 crores a month, 8 crores, whatever, depending on the category and the penetration of the category, you can build some scale online. But if you really want to be a household brand, right? Our investors, for example, are Colgate Palmolive or Reckitt Benckiser, two of the most penetrated household brands in India, right? For me, that was the aim, and that is the aim even today. I want a Bombay Shaving Company form in every house in India where someone is shaving. I can't do that through D2C or e-commerce. Sure, I can get eyeballs by marketing on Facebook and Google and building a fantastic D2C experience. But the end goal always will be to capture a shelf in a store and to capture every shelf in every store.
If you like to hear stories of founders, then we have tons of great stories from entrepreneurs who have built billion-dollar businesses. Just search for the Founder Thesis podcast on any audio streaming app like Spotify, Gaana, Apple Podcasts, and subscribe to the show.
So how did you get this off the ground? Like, this is something which needs a certain amount of upfront money in the product, you know, like you need to spend in developing the product. So did you like put in your own money? Did you raise funds? Like, you know, tell me about the launch.
Both. So I quit McKinsey in August, end of 2015, right? And my exit from the firm was I'm a very emotional kind of guy. Like I'm attached to institutions. So leaving the firm was not an easy decision or an easy process for me. Like it was like, I owe the firm a lot. Even today, like I try to, I'm a faculty at a lot of their trainings. Whenever they need help on recruitment, I'm always there as an alumnus. I exited the firm over a many month period where I had detailed long chats with a lot of the partners who were my mentors, my bosses. And the good part about McKinsey is every project is different, right? So by the end of 5 years, I had worked with like 50-60% of the firm partnership by then, at least one or the other project. Right? So every conversation, and I was a high performing guy there. Like the firm invests in you for the first 4-5 years. They let you do what you want to do. At that point, once you start becoming a partner is when you start paying back to the firm by bringing in clients and so on. Right? So I was leaving after they had invested, but I had not given back. So for the firm, it was not, they were also not very happy about the choice. But amazing, like the partners were so cool. They finally said that, look, you're not walking away from the firm. You're walking towards a dream of yours and we will never hold you back. In fact, tell me how we can be a part of your dream. And 23 McKinsey partners invested in Bombay Shaving Company when I was leaving the firm in a principal agreement that, hey, I'm writing you a check, let me just come back. Someone wrote for 15 lakhs, someone wrote for 50 lakhs, someone wrote for 30 lakhs. Aisa karke I had principal investment approvals for around 4 crores. I put in another 60 lakhs of my own. So I had a cool kitty the day the company. So this was all the approvals and all that happened before I launched the company. So I launched the company, then we got all the money in, and then I had a cool 4.6, 4.7 crore kitty. And then, brought in three of the our first three folks, Ronak, Rohit, and Deepu, into the company. One to head our brand, one to head our product development, and one to head our supply chain and process, right? So that's how we got. And then we designed our razors, we got industrial designers, we understood the procurement of shaving creams and shaving balms and aftershaves and gels and everything. Like once you go deep and you start talking to people, it's not that complex, it's just a matter of doing it well. So it took us 6-7 months, but good part is not very expensive. To take a product off the ground is not very expensive.
But don't you need a certain minimum order size for a vendor to really develop something for you?
Agar aap dekho, shaving cream dekho, our first order was, I think, 5,000 shaving creams. Each of them was for 24 rupees landed cost. 24 into 5,000 is a lakh. 1.2 lakhs. But initially, 1.2 plus, some testing, vesting, stability, certification. 1.5 to 2 lakhs. You can get the product in the warehouse. You will have to spend money in building a website, etc. But it's fairly reasonable.
Okay. So, what inventory did you launch with? Like when you started, like what was the product? How many SKUs?
Oh, interesting. We were so arrogant. I don't know. Like now it's easy to look back and laugh, but at that time we were convinced that Bombay Shaving Company is the only shaving experience worth having. So we will only sell the whole kit. You cannot buy individual products. Okay. So the kit was also like this. We felt we made the kit look real. And I think that worked for us in the long run. It had this like metal razor on top. Like think about like a like a luxurious fountain pen, right? You had a metal razor, which weighed like 100 grams. It looked beautiful. It's still like one of our best products, right? Then we had a shaving cream, a post-shave balm, and a pre-shave scrub, so like a regimen for shaving. We had a shaving brush and, Japanese blades. All of this came in like this big, nice box, like the size of a shoebox.
And this was like that single razor blade, yeah?
The single blade, right? So it's like for the purists. And this we charged $3,500 for this.
But this is such a niche product, man. Like, how many people use?
So even today, we have realized that razor and blade is something where we will struggle to beat Gillette because they have just been so good at it. That at price point in India is so hard to beat, unlike Dollar Shave Club in the US, which could beat a bigger club. Right? India is very value customer, right? So we can't win in that game. We have to win in the shaving foams, shaving creams, aftershaves, facial cleansing, face washes, face scrub. That game is where we will have to win. So yeah, we have kind of evolved significantly from this. And we said we will not sell on Amazon and Flipkart. Another very smart. You come to my website and buy. It took a long time to realize that people in the world are not as passionate about shaving as we are. So we, like this, like Colgate guy also used to tell us, the product has to kind of cater to the customer. Customer will not cater to the product. And it took us 2-3 years to learn this.
That's okay. Like when did you realize that this is not working, the strategy you took of, you know, being pure shaving experience and only on our website?
Yeah, only six, 7 months we realized that we scale nahi ho raha hai, bahut mehnga ho raha hai scale karna. Customer aa hi nahi raha. Customer aa raha hai, khareed nahi raha. To mehnga ho raha hai, aur bechna. 4,000 rupees ke product bechne ke liye we have to spend 2,000 rupees per CAC. So we were like, this is not working, man. This is not working. So we said, okay, fine. So I'll tell you, like,
how many kits did you sell in that first 6 months?
We sold a lot, yeah. I'll tell you, to be honest, our first month sale was 5 lakh rupees, right? So we sold how many? 120 kits. Then by the seventh month, our sale was 15-17 lakh rupees per month. Which is not bad. 17 lakh rupees selling only through kits is not bad.
And that too, only through your own site, you know, like
only through my own site.
And you had a fulfillment partner to do the logistics.
And yeah, Holy Soul logistics. Very, very good. Yeah, very good. One warehouse in Delhi because it was an assembled product, right? I think the first thing we did was we will sell individual products which are in this kit on our website, which is shaving cream. So the buy-in was lower that you can come and buy a shaving cream if you want, you need to buy all that. Then Amazon guys told us this guy. Where I spoke to many friends, a couple of friends from McKinsey had also left and joined Amazon, and they were like, "Boss, Shantanu, tu kuch bhi kar le, Amazon jitna traffic tu tere website pe nahi la sakta. Like there is no way." And so the product is the same, the customer is the same. The customer wants to buy on Amazon. You are taking 3 days to deliver. I'll deliver it in the same day. Why are you being stubborn? I said, "No, on Amazon they will not get the same experience." What experience? Amazon, what experience do you want on Amazon? Product listing? Brand store? I said, yeah, brand store. It's a brand store. Bana. So they, for a brand like us, which is so small, they gave us a brand store, which at that time was not something they would do for a lot of brands. Then we went on Amazon and we suddenly saw scale happening. I'm like, wow, yeah, that's an interesting thing. So a lot of this entrepreneurship journey has been very humbling that way. A lot of things that you think, you know, your ego gets broken a lot. Through the process, but I think we learned over a period of time 2-3 things, right? Which is, one, be where the customer is, right? Second is make products the customer wants. Third is be at a price point that is genuinely competitive. Just because you feel your brand is premium doesn't mean the customer feels that your brand is premium, right? So if you are making a shaving cream for 190 rupees and the average shaving cream in the market is for 50 rupees, then 145 rupees ka premium you have to justify to the customer fairly well. You can't just say, because my packaging has got, matte finish, you will pay. No, customer won't pay for that. Customer will pay 250 rupees for a shaving cream in Body Shop because the store in Body Shop and the fragrance and everything is so amazing. Right? But still, fewer people will buy. We have to really realize that we have to be where the customer is, so it will be everywhere, it will be offline. Second is, our category is lesser engaging. Right? So, we are in a low engaging category. So we have to accept it. And which means that in a high engagement category like mobile phones or cars or whatever, customer will do the research and make the choice. If you're genuinely a better product, you will get bought. But in our case, even if you're a better product, because customer will decide in like 2 seconds, you have to be there and your brand has to be a consideration brand. So invest in brand and be in every shelf. So to customer Big Bazaar mein hai, tum wahan jao. Customer Big Basket hai, tum wahan jao. Customer More mein hai, tum wahan jao. Customer Amazon pe, you have to be there. You have to be everywhere and you have to sell yourself everywhere. There's multiple things that we have learned along the way.
So, like from that 17 lakhs a month, when did you cross 1 crore a month?
We crossed a crore, 17 lakhs was already 2017 June when we raised our first round of financing from Fireside. I think we crossed a crore the year next year, like a year later.
Okay. And what led to the crore? Like, what were the contributors? You went offline, you went to Amazon. What all was it?
So we didn't go offline then. We went to Amazon. At the time, Nykaa was also building out pretty well, number one. Number two is we launched a range of products in the beard category. So beard was taking off at that time. Because we were in facial hair management, you know, shaving, beard, we kind of had a complementary equity to launch there. And because I think we raised some money, so we were able to invest in the brand.
Did you also like change your product pricing?
Yeah. So the good part, Akshay, was that our initial products, no, other than the razor, which is like at $1,800, our other products were, yeah, premium, but not so premium. Our beard range was fairly competitive. It was fairly competitive. And after that, no, we have been very, very particular that our price point has to be affordable and attractive to the customer. We're not cheap, but we are very competitive. Like, for example, a shaving foam of Bombay Shaving Company, you will get for 220 rupees. Gillette will get 190 rupees. So we are, and you know, equally good and so on.
Okay. So, you know, like, how did the Fireside deal happen? Like, you know, what did they like in you? Like,
so Kaval was the GP there. He was the founder of Fireside. We met at a mall. And I took our initial product. Oh, he loved the initial product. We were sitting at a barista in Vasant Square Mall in Vasant Kunj. He opened the product and, you know, so there are a lot of things we did right in that, right? We used to fold the towel up in a particular way and spray fragrance on it. So when the box opened, the fragrance would hit and the customer would get a good whiff, right? So he opened the product, he touched the razor. He's like, Shantanu, this is really cool stuff, man. This is really cool stuff and so on. And he said, we would like to invest in your company. Like, it was, if you basically, they were amazing. They're amazing investors to have on day one. High support, very, very emotionally attached to the brands. So you genuinely, like Kaval, Kanan, Vinay, all these guys, they buy your products as consumers, they'll give you feedback, they'll use it, and they have their now invested like in 50 companies. So, four guys keep using their brand products and giving feedback, but that they're, you know, very good. So, that was helpful.
Okay. And like, when did you start going offline then? So, like, 17, you were at like 1 crore a month.
Fireside invested in 2017 when we were at 17. 2018 August is when Colgate invested. When Colgate invested, we were at 75-80 lakhs a month. I think we hit a CR in Valentine's Day 2019.
Okay.
February 2019 when we hit a crore a month for the first time.
And how did the Colgate investment come through? Like, was that through Fireside? Like, they enabled it?
No. Fireside was, in fact, Colgate had reached out to us while the Fireside deal was going on. Their head of strategy global, who was the India CEO in the late 90s, Jay. So Jay reached out, but you know, with last strategic investors, how it is. So we said, look, we have a term sheet and we're going to go ahead with Fireside, but let's keep talking. And we kept talking, we started growing, and we, you know, Jay came back to India, we met a few times, and they loved our D2C capabilities. They loved how we thought about D2C, how we built websites, how we built marketing stacks, etc. And they felt that it will be tremendous value to learn for their teams globally also from an oral care standpoint. Plus, they really liked our men's grooming business from a palm olive synergy standpoint also. So they said, look, we'll put in a little money. We know it's not an acquisitive deal. Your two guys are too small. But we want to learn. They were early invested in Dollar Shave Club, which was, you know, something that they had kind of done well for them. So they said, we want to learn. So 2018, they invested in us, and it was, again, just a, you know, brilliant set of people. The investment was actually, this was a global decision to invest from New York. It's not the India company that invested, it's the New York company via the Hong Kong business. And at the time, Vinod Nambiar, who today is the CEO of More Retail in India, at that time he was CEO of Colgate Asia. He became a very close friend. Mukul, who today is the Asia CEO and was earlier the chief marketing officer for Colgate Global, he's a close mentor to the company. These are guys who just, you know, the money for them is very small. They're like $100 billion market business, market cap business, right? But for a small company like us doing, of course, you know, 50 lakhs a month, 60 lakhs a month, they were spending time teaching us. You know, these are guys who also understand brand management so well. They've been running like a 220-year-old brand, right? So institutionally, they understand product. Like in India, they sell 3 billion toothpastes and toothbrushes every year. They understand supply chain, they understand procurement. So we showed a lot to learn. So that's how, like, I was excited. They were excited about us for their own reasons. I was excited about them for my own reasons. And it was a match which was very well made.
Okay. So when did you go offline? Like after the Colgate investment? Like, I guess Colgate must have helped.
You know, in the India head of Colgate sales is a guy called MC. I would probably... the most knowledgeable guy in offline sales I have professionally interacted with. During the courtship period, I had met him a couple of times, and he shaped the way we thought. One of our very high performing guys, Shanky, we made him head of offline sales. We were at that time 10, 12 people. So he went to Bombay and he did a recce for like a month. And then we started cracking a few deals. We started shaping up our products to look good on our shelf. And Bombay was our first city, so we slowly went to, like, you know, 50,000 a month, 80,000 a month, then 1 lakh a month. Modern trade, we cracked La Marche in Delhi. So it's like very slow and steady approach to building out our offline sales business. Colgate coming in really helped us. And then head of Colgate offline sales for Delhi and North was a guy called Deepak Gupta. He had a personal situation at home because of which he couldn't start up, but wanted to go to a startup. So had left Colgate, wanted to go to a startup. And, you know, when the Colgate deal had just happened, so I ended up meeting him and I loved him. And he joined us to head our offline sales business. And today he's the CEO of the company, COO. But he played a fundamental part in helping Shanky kind of take the game to the next level. And today we do upwards of 2.2 crores a month only offline sales. We are the For a young brand to do that scale of business offline, and like we have grown 5 times from last March to now in like 5 quarters. So it's a very fast growing business.
And that too at a time when offline sales got hit due to the COVID thing.
Yeah. Good part is like personal care did not get affected that much because people continue to shave and wash their face and so on, right? So it was not, and plus, you know, at a business level, people, you know, continue to look online for stuff where we compete well. So overall, it works good for us. But yeah, offline did very, very well.
So what is your mix now, like offline marketplaces and D2C?
Offline plus B2B, right? So which is our gifting and corporate gifting and all that. All that put together is roughly 35% of our business. D2C is roughly 15, and 50% is marketplaces.
Okay. And how did the Reckitt investment happen?
Again, so Reckitt, I got introduced to Reckitt because the global CEO of Reckitt, who joined them in 2019, was the person who inducted me into McKinsey as a senior partner in 2011. So he was at PepsiCo, and you know, I met him in New York, and we were very close. He was very senior to me, but he was a mentor, and he's a mentor to a lot of people from the McKinsey India office. He's a very magnanimous personality, Lakshman. So Lakshman said, hey, you know, I'm joining Reckitt and I'm going to be the global CEO. Why don't you talk to a few guys about, you know, your business and how we can work together. So he kind of made an introduction email and kind of forgot about it. But the people I got introduced to were their global head of e-commerce and ERB and a couple of their senior folks. And we just hit it off. Yeah. So they were in India. We 2019. We did a lot of brainstorming on categories. They came to our office. They saw our D2C capabilities. And they said, hey, your D2C is brilliant. We feel that we can learn a lot. And not only learn a lot, like Colgate has a more soft approach where it's more, you guys learn, share, and so on. Forget all that. You guys run our D2C business. You run Durex.com, you run Enfa.com. Two of our brands, if you do well, they'll give you more brands. And then I said, look, we're not a service agency. Right? This is what you give an agency. We're not an agency. We're a brand business. You didn't know, I understand that. Right? But if you run our business, your company will also benefit. You will, you'll make some money. Your team will get learnings. You can, so much benefit comes from running a big brand. I agree with that, right? So I said, sure, okay, cool. Why don't we do it? But if you want us to do this, you have to invest equity in the company. So that was, they were like, okay, should we invest equity? But you already have Colgate. And I said, look, all of them matter. Colgate are also strategically important for us. You guys are strategically important for us. You guys, Colgate and Reckitt don't compete. You guys are a hygiene health business. Colgate is a oral care, personal care, beauty business. So what's the issue? So they're like, okay. So then it took a long time for them to agree to it. But once the ball gets rolling, until I think it stops only after it stops, right? So we kind of got a shareholder agreement together. We introduced the Colgate guys, the Reckitt guys. They got along well. And today we are a small business with two globally large companies as strategic investors sitting on the cap table with all these other McKinsey and other angels. So it's an interesting cap table.
So which brands are you running for Reckitt?
Durex and Enfa.
What is Enfa?
It's a milk substitute for young kids. So
okay, like Pediasure.
Yeah, Nanpro, etc. Right. So they have a brand called Enfamil. They have Enfagro. They have. It was owned by this company called Mead Johnson, and it's one of if not the world's largest brand. I think it's a $3.5-4 billion brand globally. But in India, they have. Entered later, so they're picking up now in India, and I think my personal belief is D2C is a fantastic place because high AOV, high repeat, subscribable business. If the child likes the taste, then the parents are not going to go to any other brand. They'll just say, "Okay, fine, my Neka base will come on, right?" And the other one is Durex, which is like the sexiest category possible. So those are two brands we're going to run. We are in the process of handing over the websites to us and running it.
So how much money will you make in this? Like, is it a percentage of sales arrangement with you, or what is it like?
It's a percentage of sales arrangement. It's a percentage of sales arrangement and a percentage and a bonus kicker for achieving growth targets.
Okay. But how much do you think it will contribute to your revenue? Like,
not a lot. Yeah. Initially single digit, but I think for us, it's not, we're not in this for the revenues. We're in it for the learnings, and I think it helps us flex our muscles a lot. Just running BombayShavingCompany.com will help you get to a certain level. But if you suddenly start doing three, four different things, three, four different target pools of audiences, three, four different kinds of media which you're buying, just your team becomes much sharper if they do three, four different things. So I think that's what is more exciting for me.
So you've told me a couple of times in our conversation that a lot of investors were impressed with your D2C stack. Tell me about that. Like, what all does it include, and how did you build that up?
I always feel that D2C is something which, like, people use this term a lot, right?
Yeah.
And it's now becoming like this cultish thing that D2C, like people who don't do D2C feel like, oh, we need to, like, everyone feels we need to do D2C, etc. I think the idea was simple. I think it is about doing a lot of simple things really well, rather than doing like three, four big silver bullet kind of things, right? Building a really conversion friendly website, for example, right? It's super critical. making sure that loading times and customer journeys are as clean as possible, making sure payments are zero on failure. Like, everyone knows this. I'm not saying something which people don't know. For bringing the right people to the website very economically, right? Being on top of media buying. So Facebook, Instagram, Google are the most important media spend you'll make. But the sophistication of data that you get as a marketer is amazing, right? You will know exactly what kind of audience interacts with what kind of ad set for what kind of product and how it converts or what kind of click rates you get, right? We run experiments through the roof, right? Every ad set is like a experiment for us. So you keep learning, you keep becoming better. So you keep doing small things. And an increment, it's a goal by 1,000 passes approach. Good D2C, in my view, is a goal by 1,000 passes. You see the final goal, it's a tap-in. It doesn't look sexy and it definitely doesn't, feel like you've achieved a lot. But the process is one where the team continuously gets better and better and better. So continuous review and doing the small things, 1,000 small things really well, I think is what makes D2C work for us.
So you, in your initial hiring, did not have a guy to build the D2C stack, no? Like,
we had a product design guy, a procurement guy, and a marketing guy. So me and the marketing guy built it out initially. McKinsey has taught us that if you're a generalist, then you should be able to solve any problem. So for the first 2-3 years, it was me only doing everything. Then we got someone senior to look at D2C. We got a few, we started learning this from few junior folks who had done this for brand at a scale, like Myntra, for example. We got a lot of experts to come and teach us through workshops how to do D2C. A close friend of mine was someone senior at Facebook, so we asked him to set up something for Facebook advertising. So we were very curious and we were very eager to learn.
And because you were hands-on, so I guess that's like a very strong part of the company DNA, since you personally built it up.
Correct, absolutely. For the first 3 years, 3.5 years, I was three times a day, reviews, problem-solving sessions, whiteboard sessions, all the time. So that's when you build the foundational muscle. And then after that, I've gotten lesser and lesser involved as and how people far smarter than me joined the team. My requirement was kind of made irrelevant, which is great for me. It allows me to focus on things that I like doing.
What is it that you like doing? What are you focusing on?
So I've realized as a CEO, I'm not as good an operator as I am a strategy guy. So I'm able to see patterns much better than I'm able to execute a particular, let's say, piece of work. My job, I think the CEO's job is 3-4 things, right? Number one is setting a very clear mandate for the next 3, 6, and 12 months, continuously.
Okay. For the organization and the team.
For the organization, for the leadership team, and for each team, individual teams in the company, right? So mandate setting happens at multiple levels. Then second is defining what the vision of the business is for the long term and over communicating it. I think I sound like a broken record nowadays, but this is what we're doing with every all hands, every interaction, just reminding people of what the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow is, really. Third thing is to keep the company financially stable and to be financially compliant, right? Have a very clear understanding of your financials, how much money you need, what kind of margin structure you have today. What are the decisions you need to make the margin structure better, etc. Those are the third job. And fourth job, I think, is for a culture of performance and emotional health of the business, right? Which is 120 people have to work in a particular way, have to interact with each other in a particular way. CEO and founder holds that close a lot. But on execution, operation, day-to-day decisions, week-on-week decisions, even target achievements, my CEO and my leadership team look at it far better than I do. And it's not even a skill of mine, to be honest. I don't do that well.
So teach me how to do mandate setting. Do you put it on paper with numbers, or is it like a more aspirational kind of a mandate you set, or, you know, like, how do you do that?
So I think the mandate is, at the end of the day, hey, this is what the business expects you to achieve. But there has to be a very strong reason to believe. That, okay, for example, we are doing very well in women's hair removal today. For example, it's now 20% of our business. Okay. We started as a men's business. We're now reinventing into a men and women business. Now, we are in the process of setting the mandate for our women's hair removal business. So how do you do that? Right? You say, okay, fine. I want to build 100 crore women's hair removal brand in India. Okay. That's the mandate. Why it makes sense for me. Okay. Number one. India is a 20,000 crore women hair removal market, of which 95% is vaccine services. Okay, but 5% and growing is products, which is razors and hair removal cream and so on. Women, younger women especially, want a razor in the purse. Okay, Nykaa has told us that that's what they want. We are going to listen to them, and initial feelers are that it's going to work. Vaccine is inconvenient and painful. Women don't have time. If they want to go for a party tonight or they want to go for a date tonight, they want to wear something, a skirt, they will shave their legs. So you have to be the razor there, okay? There's the competitive landscape, unlike men, where Maxi and Fusion are such good products. In women's hair removal, our product is far better than any other offering. So we believe that this is, that the reason to believe is high, right? Hence is the mandate. Now,
and how did the 100 crore number come? And is that a number you tell your team that you need to hit 100 crore turnover in the next 12 months? Like, is that how you set the mandate?
Yes.
Okay. And how did that number come?
It's basically I want to get to 5 crore per month by end of the year and 10 crore per month by end of next year, by June of next year. Pretty much as simple as that. It's a run rate thing. And for that, you need to sell these many units. This is the average price. Here is how the channel structure or channel mix is going to be. And here is what the large market is. Here is the budget for marketing. Now figure it out.
And this is where the intuition also comes in. Like you said, that consultants don't have that intuition, but this would be a gut driven number. It is
triangulated, right? So I know, for example, how big Venus is. I know how big Beat is. I know how big Kai and Tinkle are. I know number of searches for women's hair removal products across Google and Amazon. I know the size of the category offline. I know what is the size of the category in stores that my men's products sell. So I'm able to triangulate a lot of these things to say, okay, fine. Today I'm at 1.3 crores. What's the journey from 1.3 crores a month to 6 crores a month? Like, how does that waterfall build up in my mind? Like, and how much do I have to invest in that? And then I give the mandate to the team saying, this is my belief. Mandates are always presentations. They're never asks. So mandate setting is a 5 to 7 page slide deck that I make and present and say, you either disagree with me and tell me. I would be delighted if you can be more ambitious than me. I cannot accept it if you are less ambitious than I am. Unless I have gotten some assumptions wrong. So you tell me, no, Shantanu, you're overestimating the market size or you're underestimating the competitive difficulties. So let's have a discussion. Let me have a discussion on it. And many times my team convinces me that I'm, you know, either being over ambitious or under ambitious or whatever. But once they align, then I let them go and then they hire on their own, they figure it out on their own, and I just review every month and so on.
Amazing. So in a way, you sell a vision using a deck on why that vision can be achieved and in what timeline.
Absolutely. Then sometimes I have to hire the right person for that mandate. If the person doesn't exist, if I feel that this mandate needs to be run by an individual and people in my team don't have the bandwidth or the capability, or I think I need someone else, then I also go and hire. That also becomes my job, which is, you know, senior team, setting up a senior team.
Okay. And so what is your product range now? Like you said, you've gone into women's hair removal. So what else is there now?
So we have men's shaving, which is, you know, razors, trimmers, aftershaves, shaving cream, shaving foams, shaving balms, etc. It's a whole shaving range. We have a lot of facial hair management solutions, right? Our beard range, our charcoal face washes, etc. We have hair oils. We have for and you know charcoal face pack and stuff like that for men, right? For women, we have 3-4 different kind of razors. We have a post shave balm, lavender soothing balm, and we have a pre shave foam for women. And of course, you know, eyebrow razor, face razor, bikini razor, foldable razor. We have a body razor, etc.
Okay, so where do you stand in the pecking order? Like, you know, like there is Manco and there's Beardo. So, you know, in like between your peers, like, are you like, you know, where do you stand? Like, are you bigger than the others, or are there other peers who are bigger? Or?
So it depends on the category. So, for example, in shaving, we are bigger than all of these guys. Other than we are smaller than Gillette, Nivea, and possibly Vijon, but we are bigger than the others. Okay. In beard, they're much bigger than us. Right? Beardo is much bigger than us. Beardo, Ustra, Mancopy are bigger than us in the beard category. From an overall business, in women's hair removal, Venus and Veet are bigger than us, but we are climbing very quickly and competing very hard, right? From an overall standpoint, I think Beardo and Man Company are probably 20-25% bigger than we are. And Ustra is probably the same size as we are. Not sure last 3-4 months how COVID has been for them. But I really respect these guys, by the way. Like, I think what Beardo, Man Company, and Ustra have all built outstanding brands in new categories, which is not easy to do. So we took on shaving, which is an established category. So it's much easier to build a proposition there. But building a new category like beard was just insanely difficult, and they did a fantastic job of it.
So how has COVID been for you? Like,
very good for us. Like, wow. I know the country went through like unbelievably tragic, you know, experiences. Three of our colleagues have lost a parent, right? From a business standpoint, two things happened, right? One is personal care products went up from a category standpoint. People bought more of it, right?
Why is that? Like, why did that happen? They're not spending on going out, so they spend on pampering.
Yeah, and you have to show your face, no, on Zoom calls in office and all. It's not like you have to wash your face, you have to shave, you have to trim your beard, you have, like, all the usage continues. In fact, you're at home all the time, so you won't even use the bad stuff that you get in hotels and, you know, all of that stuff. You're continuously buying stuff. Second thing is people are buying online. So when people move from offline to online, it's much easier for us. Like, Gillette is in 2 million stores in India. We are in 50,000 stores. So offline, we can't compete as well yet. But you put all of us in an online store, then our ability to compete is much higher. So when traffic online goes up, we take a significant chunk of that traffic for our products.
So what is your current monthly rate? Are you at liberty to?
Yeah, we do 8.5 crores a month now. So we are looking to, like, we're a solid 100 crore brand now. So we are hoping to increase by 50% this year.
Okay. So what's like a 5-year vision for Bombay Shaving Club? What all categories do you see yourself in?
I think men's shaving, we want to be bigger than Gillette in the consumables business. Right? We want to be bigger than Nivea in the consumables. So I think...
So what do you mean by consumables? Like the razor?
The non-razor blade business. Like the shaving cream, shaving foam, aftershave, balms, that stuff, right? Like, we want to own that, right? Through our superfood proposition, through our amazing packaging, really sensorial product experiences, we want to own that. So, I think 500 crore business there, and we want to own women's hair removal from a product experience standpoint also. That's another 500 crore business. So, we want to be a 1,000 crore business. Which owns hair removal for men and women in the next 5 years.
Okay. Do you see yourself getting acquired? Like, you know, say, like, if RB, like, is really impressed with how you're handling the D2C, they might just decide to bring you in.
Yeah. So always see, I think acquisition is should be a more practical decision than an emotional one. So if the value is right, the time is right, look, I always feel that self-grown brands sometimes need a home to achieve their next realm of growth, right? You can, let's say we can go to 200 crores, but if RB or Colgate buys us and they can take us to every store and every salesperson of Colgate or RB has Bombay Shaving Company as a separate line item in their targets, they can do in 1 year what we will take 5 years to do. So isn't that better for the company?
Yeah.
If they acquire us at a good at a fair value, is that good return on investment to all the people who have put in the money over many years?
Yes.
Do employees feel that, you know, do they make money?
Yes.
Do they get more professional opportunities as a part of a huge company like Colgate or Reckitt, working in many geographies, working in many countries, working in multiple functions, learning and becoming more seasoned FMCG executive? Absolutely. At the right value, right future intent. Every company needs to think hard rather than taking what I feel is a very myopic view of saying, oh, I don't want to lose my you know, freedom. And that's all. I think Indian promoters associate, like, the reason why Indian promoters don't sell is that their identity is their company. And then they end up kind of refusing really what I feel are lucrative and better things for the company. But for us, when the time is right, if the offer comes, if it works for our investors, if it works for our employees, if it's good for the brand, we'll do it.
And what is it that you are personally passionate about? You know, like, so one is, of course, building Bombay Shaving Club. But besides that, like, you know, Shantanu as a person, what is it that you seek to learn, or how do you seek to spend your time when you're not building Bombay Shaving Club? Or it's like 24/7 Bombay Shaving.
No. I'm a very regular guy. I love watching sports. I am on online. I devour content online. Like, I'm on Twitter, and I have so many varied interests. I love music. I play the tabla. I love hanging out with my friends. So for me, like, if you remove Bombay Shaving Company from my life, I will be very happy to spend time. I'm a very social guy. I make friends easily. And, you know, I also want to get into teaching now. So I've started getting interested a lot in, like, primary and middle school mathematics. I feel that if 8 to 14 year olds in India are taught mathematics the right way, we will have a very different kind of workforce that comes out in the future. So I'm thinking how I can do that, because I have a passion for teaching mathematics to school. My friends' kids, for example, I'm curious to see how I can teach many of them math. But I have a lot of passion.
If you like this story, then do check out the amazing range of products that Shantanu is offering at BombayShavingCompany.com.
Like the Founder Thesis podcast, then do check out our other shows on subjects like marketing, technology, career advice, books, and drama. Visit thepodium.in, that is thepodium.in, for a complete list of all our shows.
This episode of Founder Thesis podcast is brought to you by Long Haul Ventures. Long Haul Ventures is the long haul partner for founders and startups that are building for the long haul. More about them is at www.longhaulventures.com.